This past January marked 15 years since George W. Bush's 2002 declaration that Iran is a member of the Axis of Evil, along with Iraq and North Korea, as a state sponsor of terror seeking weapons of mass destruction and one of the most nefarious powers in the Middle East. The revolutionary power has since played an outsized role in U.S. foreign policy in the region. Throughout the history of the global wars on terror, the Obama administration's efforts to open doors to it through the JCPOA, while it simultaneously tried and did not succeed to withdraw the U.S. from conflicts in the region. Now, under the Trump administration, Iran is formally on notice, though we have yet to see how such declarations align with any changes in America's foreign policy. So, what are the goals of Iran for its neighborhood? And how is it actively trying to achieve them? And how does U.S. policy, past and present, address Iran's intentions? Well, that's precisely what we're going to discuss today. I'm your moderator, Paul Schenkman, National Security Correspondent for U.S. News and World Report, and I would usually be much more long-winded, but I don't want to take any more time away from my distinguished panel up here on the dais. And allow me to introduce them. From your left to right, Mohammed Al-Yahya is a non-resident fellow with the Atlantic Council, where he focuses on counterterrorism and Middle East security, U.S. policy for the region, and violent extremism. He serves on the advisory board for the Future Trends in the GCC at Chatham House and was previously a fellow at the King Faisal Center for Research and Islamic Studies. Rhonda Slim is the director of Track 2 Dialogues for the Middle East Institute, our gracious hosts today, has long experience in peace-building processes in the Middle East and Central Asia, particularly focusing on Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq. She is a non-resident fellow at the SAIS Foreign Policy Institute. She has developed and managed a series of dialogue and peace-building projects elsewhere throughout the region and particularly in Iraq. Skipping over your moderator, Matt McInnes is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he focuses on Iran and its activities through strategic, culture, and military power, in addition to U.S. security and defense issues throughout the Persian Gulf region. He previously held a series of analytical and leadership positions at the Department of Defense, centering on those issues, among others. So the way that I would like for this to go this afternoon, I'm planning to ask each of our distinguished speakers a couple questions about some specific areas throughout the region. I'll ask a couple follow-up questions, and I'd very much like to turn over to you and hear what sorts of questions you might have. And, of course, once we get to that time, we'll be asking for a question, please, when you do ask one. So please think of those now. So, Rhonda, perhaps we can start with you, and let's focus on Iraq for a moment. We've reached an instrumental time with the declared liberation of Mosul. Iranian forces and Iranian-backed forces have played an instrumental role in that campaign. I'd be interested to hear perhaps just sort of a brief primer on what those forces are, the extent to which they have exerted some sort of power in Iraq. And how do you think they might complicate the post-conflict political reconciliation and the rebuilding?
Thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to be with you all, and I look forward to a lively discussion. And I think when you talk about these forces, especially the pro-Iranian forces, they fall within the rubric called the popular mobilization forces, which were formed based on a fatwa from Sayyid Ali Sistani, the Shi'i Marja, right after the fall of Mosul in June 2014. The numbers are, I heard a range of numbers for the popular mobilization forces, anywhere from 100 to 140,000. That's based on discussions, conversation I've had with Iraqi officials who are in charge of the popular mobilization forces. Now, there are two categories of popular mobilization forces, one that is pro-Iran, and then the other that is more, if we can call it Iraqis that are either loyal to Sistani himself or loyal to Muqtada al-Sadr, the Iraqi Shiite cleric known as Saraya al-Salam. Now, what's the percentage of each category within the total of popular mobilization forces? Some people say it is 60-40, some people say it's 50-50. However, going forward, you know, which of these will be demobilized, which will these stay in place? I think it's a little bit early to say that. Even there have been talk about the Marja, Sayyid Sistani, issuing another fatwa calling on the people to go back to their home, because until now he refers to them as volunteers for the defense of Iraq, and so it will. So the argument goes that there would be a fatwa asking them to decommission, especially the older among them, the former former state employees among them, to go back to their job. However, what I'm hearing from the Marja'iyya circle is that they even themselves feel it's a bit too early to call for these people to be demobilized, that the threat of ISIS, you know, is still present in some parts of Iraq. There are parts of Iraq that are still under ISIS control. And the expectation is that the fight against ISIS will last definitely through 2017 and maybe till the middle of next year. Now, the question about the popular mobilization forces is something that is now it's a hot topic inside Iraq. There has been tension between Prime Minister Abadi and the Hashd leaders about the future of the PMF. There has been a law passed in November 2016 making the PMF as part of the security, structures, although an independent part of the security structure, but not allowed to play a political role. Now, what happens to the PMF is very much determined, in my opinion, by what Iran wants them, the role Iran wants them to play in, especially the ones that are affiliated with Iran, what role Iran wants them to play in the future of Iraq. And it will have repercussion both on intra-Shiite politics as well on Sunni-Shiite politics. It's clear based on, you know, what we are hearing from some of the pro-Iran PMF leaders, people like Al-Muhandis, Qais Al-Khaz'ali, Hadi Al-Amiri, that they do not see, they do not want to be decommissioned, that they see a future for the PMF. The recent debate between Abadi on one hand and the PMFs and the disputes over the future of PMF center around 4 to 5 issues. One is, under whose authority do the PMF fall? The leadership of the PMF, you know, who's going to be the leader of the PMF and the deputy leader. The PMF leaders like Amiri want the leadership to be put in the hands of a political figure, whereas Abadi wants the leadership of the PMF to be a skilled person with a military background to be leading this force. The second is their role in the security of Baghdad and the security of the highway linking Baghdad to Jordan. The PMF leadership wants to have a role in that, and Abadi is opposed to that. And then the third is whether the PMF should play a role outside Iraq. Mm. And some of them have already, you know, and are already playing a role in the fight in Syria, whereas Abadi is definitely, you know, saying that, you know, the role of the PMF should be limited to security issues. And then the fourth issue is the number. Abadi wants to bring down the number total of all the PMF to 80,000, whereas there is give and take over, you know, how many of them will remain. Mm.
So, Matt, I'll pose the same question to you. We've heard a lot about Iranian-backed forces in Syria. Most recently, the strike that the U.S. carried out against some sort of militia that was massing near Special Operations Force in Atanf, for example. Give us a sense of to what extent these groups are indeed directly linked to Iran or acting in Iran's best interest. What are you seeing there?
Okay. Yes, thank you, Paul. What we're seeing in Syria in some ways is very similar or different versions of what Iran has been building up over the years in Iraq and in creating various militias that are either directly proxies, that you can see legitimate command and control coming down from Tehran through the Revolutionary Guard Corps and Quds Force, through their representatives there in Iraq, on down to the various forces, along with others that, as Rhonda was mentioning, that are more nationalistic or more tied to Iraqi spiritual or political leadership. But Iran still, controls one and works with both. This is the dynamic that we've seen develop, what I call the Iraqi model of creating these types of forces and having that Iranianization of the state's security apparatus, which is a slow process, which you've seen in a different way in Lebanon for the last several decades. And it's developed, of course, in Iraq since 2003. When it came to Syria, Iran had to, in many ways, use a lot of tools that it had in its usual kit, but also had to come up with some new stuff, because the situation there, in many ways, was more dire. And in particular, one of the things that I felt, we missed a lot of times early on in our analysis, we collectively being the United States and some of our allies, the degree of how existential Syria is in the preservation of Assad's regime was to Iran, that Iran has to pretty much do whatever it takes to sustain that regime. And I think we early on had too much of an idea that Syria is a very close ally, but it's more of a marriage of convenience as opposed to something that is existentially linked to Tehran's regime and to Tehran's, from their perspective, survival and legitimacy. And because of that, they were also having to deal with a partner in Syria that was very flawed, as we all know. But it's not simply because of, how awful Assad is, but also because Assad's forces are simply not capable of doing the job during the civil war. The interesting thing, though, is Iran felt it had to kind of come in and salvage the situation, but it realized its own form of typical amalgam of proxies, local forces, and more elite units that are more directly controlled by Tehran, that didn't necessarily work. You see this period from 2011 all the way to the present day of steady amounts of escalation of Iran's involvement and what I consider creativity and how to make their old form of warfare that they've used, for years in Lebanon and then in Iraq, as well as make it work in Syria. And I think you've seen certain things are very similar, like the PMF in Iraq. You have, the National Defense Forces that are trying to, mobilize local Syrian, particularly Shia, but also some non-Shia elements to augment Assad's forces. But they also, of course, had to create what we sometimes like to call the Shia Foreign Legion that has developed, that combines elements of not only their classic capabilities from Lebanese Hezbollah and their more established proxies in Iraq, but also kind of growing these new militia groups and being able to integrate them in some way and move them around the theater, move them from, Syria to Iraq. Sometimes now we now see them down in Yemen, and being able to rotate these types of units around theater. And then even that, though, wasn't sufficient. So Iran had to start looking at creating its, these mobile, basically deployed headquarters from the Revolutionary Guard Corps and even their regular army, the Artesh, to help manage through the training, equip, and directing of strategy. They started doing that, 2013, 2014. But by the time we get to 2015, it's still not sufficient. And then we enter into the Russian in development. And what's been fascinating is as Iran keeps trying to find ways to win in Syria, and it's a big question of whether it's truly winning in Syria or not, because it's never quite there, and feeling satisfied and feeling secure, that having the Russians come in, is something that, on the one hand is a new strategic dynamic for Iran. We haven't seen that kind of relationship with a world power since 1979. But also these groups and the Revolutionary Guard, both the militia groups that Iran is running, and the Revolutionary Guard Corps itself is is learning from Russia and how to fight differently. And the kind of Russian hybrid warfare that we have seen, from in Ukraine, some of this is versions of what they fought in Chechnya, and seeing that, intermeshed with what the Iranians are doing, the Iranians are having to learn ad hoc style like they typically do, and how to succeed. And what's been fascinating is seeing this new form of warfare that Suzanne Maloney mentioned in the first panel is this kind of new expeditionary warfare, because the old ways, the old asymmetric ways of fighting for Iran are just not sufficient.
Interesting. So, Mohammed, let's go outside of Iraq and Syria for a second. We often hear about the sort of power battle in the Middle East as being one of the Sunni-Shia divide, as of Saudi Arabia and Iran competing for that regional power. What do you see as the countries that are most invested in containing Iran? How effective are they? And are they the threats that Tehran itself sees?
So the prevalent narrative that we've been hearing, at least over the past 8 years, is that the United States has removed an isolated third party in a regional conflict that's almost 1,400 years old between a Sunni power and a Shia power. And I think that's very problematic. First of all, because the problem isn't between Iran and Saudi Arabia. The problem essentially is between Saudi Arabia and the United States. When Iran attacks Saudi Arabia for the 1996 Khobar bombings, for example, when it attacks U.S. Marines in Beirut, these are attacks against the United States and not Saudi Arabia. If you were to go to Riyadh and ask them what the largest security threat for the kingdom is, they'll invariably tell you that it's Iran. If you go to Tehran, on the other hand, and ask them what the largest security threat for Tehran is, they will invariably tell you it's a great state and it's the United States. So the idea that this is a regional rivalry between Saudi Arabia, a country that wants to push forward the interests of Sunnis in the region, and Iran, a country that wants to promote the interests of Shias in the region, I think is very problematic. That's the first thing. When it comes to Syria, I think the strategic significance of Syria has been underplayed in Washington a lot. Iraq takes a lot of the spotlight, and Syria doesn't. Syria is very important for Iran, and I agree with my colleague when he mentioned how integral it is to Iranian policy. If the Syrian crisis is resolved and the government that is not pro-Iran is installed there, that will be the end of Hezbollah. They will not have access to ammunition. They will not have access to logistical support from Iran. There will be no corridor by which they can sustain themselves going forward. It's going to be slow. It's going to be a painful death, especially since we've seen them depleted to a great extent in Syria already. They've been losing thousands of fighters. And that's something that I think the Iranian regime is not prepared to do. Hezbollah is too important of a group for Iran, as a bargaining chip for Iran, and that's why they're going to protect Bashar al-Assad at all costs. And I think it's also worth mentioning that, the idea of a Syrian army there is no more Syrian army. It exists maybe in a little bit more than name. What we have right now is on the ground Fatemi Yun, Zainabi Yun fighters from Afghanistan and Pakistan. So these fighters are shipped into Syria by Iran. They're given stipends, and they're given the promise of permanent residency in Iran after they return. And then you have that's the cannon fodder, if you like. Above them you have large numbers of military advisors, quote-unquote, from the IRGC, and they're heavily embedded in the Syrian security service. And they're essentially controlling everything on the ground and moving these militias around, Hezbollah, the Fatemi Yun and Zainabi Yun, and the various other militias and the remnants of what used to be the Syrian Arab Army. And of course, the Russians are on top of all of this. They control the air, and they exert a lot of political influence on Assad. But the idea that Assad still has some sort of sovereignty, that he can still make decisions in Syria, is very problematic, because on a top level, the Russians control a lot of the political process. And then when you look at the actual institutions in the country, they're heavily infiltrated by the IRGC. The IRGC is in control from the most simple and lower organizational mechanisms until the top of the security service there.
I think also what's important to recognize right now, there is a deal being struck between the United States and Russia on Syria. I think what's most important to consider is that any area that's liberated cannot be left to be governed by the Assad regime. I think what the Assad regime is going to try to do is convince the Russians and convince the Americans that all they want to send is teachers or trash collectors or whatever it is, and that's it. As soon as they send anybody to Raqqa, as soon as they send anybody to Deir ez-Zor, any area that's liberated, what that will mean is that they will exert total control over these areas and we're back at square one. It's not a lasting solution. It is just going to ensure that this conflict drags on even further. I'm pretty sure the Gulf states have showed shown willingness to contribute to the post-conflict dynamics in Syria to rebuild, but I don't think that this is going to happen either in Syria or in Iraq without ample assurances that the very elements that cause groups like ISIS to flourish are going to take root in the areas that that are liberated.
So I'd be interested to go into a little bit more about why Iran is doing these things. Rondo, when you look at the forces and resources that Iraq is, or that Iran is putting into Iraq and Syria, do you see a master plan that is being carried out through these activities? Do you see opportunism and the temporary solution happens to be these kinds of forces? Do you also see taking advantage perhaps of dysfunction and Iran has a effective option that it can deploy, for example, in the form of the PMF, that might be more effective at taking territory than, say, you know, a uniformed Iraqi forces?
I mean, Iraq has always been an important determining factor in Iran's national security doctrine. There is a past of a conflictual relationship between Iran and Iraq, which has resulted in high level of mistrust, which exists today between at the level of the Iraqi and the Iranian political elites. There are challenges that Iran have always seen emerging from Iraq, mostly having to do with the diversity of the ethno-sectarian makeup of Iraq that has created challenges as well as opportunities for Iraq to mine those divisions, to project itself as an arbitrator among different competing Iraqi factions. There is also the cultural and religious weight of Iraq in the Shiite world, as well as in the Islamic world, that has also presented limits to what Iran can do in Iraq versus to what Iran can do in Syria or what Iran can do in Lebanon. Iraq has somebody called Sayyid al-Sistani. I mean, this is a powerful Shiite force that so far has been able to regulate a little bit the game that is being played among the Shiite forces. At the same time, also present, some kind of limits on how far Iran can go into the control it can establish in Iraq over the Shiite community. Such figure does not exist among the Shiite community in Lebanon. Such figure does not exist among the Alawites in Syria. And that's why who succeeds Sistani going forward is going to be extremely important to Iran, but also to Iraq, and to the role, to the influence that Iran can have in Iraq. Historically, what we know, historically but also since 2003, is that the factor that has been most influential in limiting Iranian sway over Iraqi politics is the health of the Iraqi political system. Mm-hmm. A divided Iraq, a weak Iraq, is a boon for Iran. When Iraq is strong, when Iraq is united, Iran has less opportunities to mine these lines of division that exist inside Iraq between its different entities. And that's why going forward, especially since the fall of Mosul, there is now a spirit of unity, you know, that is shared by the different components of Iraqi society. There is support for Prime Minister Abadi, who has shown a fair degree of independence, or at least willingness to stand up to Iran on certain issues, because every Iraqi prime minister knows he cannot or she cannot be in power or remain in power without Iranian acquiescence. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a fact. But they can play on the margin. They can play figuring out certain rules of the game, you know, that enable him and enable some of the political elites that would like to keep a certain level of independence from Iran, enable them to keep Iranian influence at least under check. And there are challenges facing Iraq going forward, which without the help of the Americans, without the help of the Arab countries, I think it's going to be very hard for Iraq on its own to shoulder. And that's why, as I know, we are still awaiting this, you know, Syria-Iraq strategy from the Trump administration that is going to supposedly be revealed, you know, any day now. But I hope that we have learned from our mistake in 2011 of a premature exit from Iraq and the price we had to pay and the price especially Iraqis had to pay as a result of that decision. I think Iraq today faces a unique opportunity, but it's also a short window of time, you know, it's a whereby they can, with the help of Arabs, with the help of the Americans, can prevent from the establishment of a permanent Hezbollah-like structure in Iraq. It's a very short window of, you know, it's a very short window, and I don't think it's going to last for a long time. And American assistance to Iraq security forces, to Iraq police, American assistance to Iraqi government in dealing with the huge economic challenges facing it now, Arab countries' willingness to invest in reconstruction of the territories liberated from ISIS in Ramadi, in Fallujah, in Mosul is important in investing these countries in the future security of Iraq. And American assistance is important in basically sending a message to especially Iraqi political elite that they have a choice to make, that it's not only, you know, it's not only Iran that is going to be the arbitrator of the political game in Iraq. We have a little bit more of influence today in Iraq than we had pre-June 2014, mm-hmm. because of the economic assistance, because of the military assistance, and how we are going to be able to build on that, build on the goodwill that many Iraqis feel toward the Americans now because of the assistance in fighting ISIS that the American forces have provided, is going to be important.
Matt, tell me what you see in Syria. It's a neighboring country, but obviously a very different situation. Does Iran see opportunities for cooperation? Is there more space for it to try out, test out, develop its own military, give it some experience? What do you see there?
Yeah, I think from remembering in the relative importance of Syria, and how Iran is looking at it as both, as we talked about before, an existential issue, but also as, you know, they are experimenting there and there are potential, you know, ways they can take, if they, again, it goes back to the issue of are they winning in Syria? And the thing is I typically remind people they used to have access, you know, to Lebanese Hezbollah via, the Assad regime, pretty much for free. And now they have to pay a very, very high price to ensure that. At the same time, in the last 6 years, as they've had to come up with new and more creative ways of doing that, they are finding that Syria is a place for them to grow militarily and to create new capabilities that can be potentially used, as we've even seen some degree of threat already that this new, you know, the new Shia Foreign Legion or you know, expanded axis of resistance is going to be potentially used in the next Israel-Lebanon conflict. And it's part of the reason what's driving, you know, some of the current back and forth, you know, with us and Israel and Russia and Iran and kind of negotiating what's going to happen in southern Syria and the de-escalation zone. Again, a lot of what was driving, in addition to the things I've already mentioned, is that Iran felt after the Gaza conflict in 2014 that, you know, its deterrence against Israel via its proxy groups, including Lebanese Hezbollah, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and others, was insufficient. That they recognized their weakness that they had in influencing events inside the Palestinian territories and deterring Iran as deterring Israel, including, you know, Israel's increasing missile defense capabilities. That's what's kind of driving a good portion of Iran's strategy in Syria, especially this acceleration of advanced weaponry that is going to Lebanese Hezbollah in the process of, and the attempts to establish something in the Golan Heights. All these things were, you know, are seen as imperative for Iran to be able to deter Israel more effectively than it has in the last few years. And so I think that Iran has multiple things going on in Syria, and I'm afraid that, you know, if they look at this, frankly, as a war of attrition, I would argue, they have more will to stand there than anyone else. Even if they don't have the strongest capabilities there in the Syrian theater, Syria matters more to them than any of the other external players that are currently, including us and the Russians and Turks and others. And so I think that they are willing to wait this out. They know it's going to be painful. They know it's going to be very ugly long term. But I think for the Iranians, they see, you know, Syria as the place where if we can survive, we will have new capabilities. We will have a new Syrian state that will have deep Iranian influence at many levels. And we will have this kind of new expeditionary force that we can deploy around the region, use that to pressure, to coerce, as well as deter our adversaries, not only Israel, but of course the Saudis and our other Arab partners.
Going to you, Mohammed, again, looking outside of Iraq and Syria, particularly when you look at strife, any form of a regional strife, you often hear the word Iran bandied about. Most recently, we're witnessing problems with the GCC, with the list of demands that Saudi Arabia and its bloc of countries have placed against Qatar over, apparently, Qatar's connections to Iran. Do you see that as part of a plan that Iran has in place to break apart these alliances? Do you see it as just taking advantage, or is it just becoming sort of a boogeyman among some people for laying blame?
I don't think Iran has any hand in what's happening in the GCC, and Qatar's connection or engagement with Iran is just one aspect of many that the quartet, the four states that are boycotting Qatar, there are long-standing grievances. They're 20 years old. There are severe disagreements in terms of counterterrorism strategy and counterterrorism policy. There's a lot to iron out in terms of that conflict, but it inevitably, a GCC that's not unified is definitely good for Iran. And the longer that this conflict lasts, the more Iran stands to benefit in the region.
So I'd be interested to hear about, now that we've sort of looked at what's happening in the region, how the U.S. can be more involved. Rhonda, you've talked a bit about the importance of U.S. Treating Iraq like the ally that it is, and the power that then comes to offset other regional actors. What tools do you think are at the U.S. disposal to contain Iran, to offset its influence, and do you think that we're using it to the full extent that we can?
Well, we need a strategy first. And then second, we need people on the ground to enable the implementation of the strategy. And we seem to be short on both. And so, and by people, I don't mean the military. I mean, we have tried the military and nation building, and that did not go well in the first round of, I mean, diplomats. I mean, people who can engage with Iraqis on the political, security, economic issues that they are struggling with. Look, if we compare Syria to Iraq, and if you compare about which of these two places the U.S. has a shot at limiting, I mean, this rolling back Iranian influence, I think we should abandon this idea. It's not going to happen. I mean, Iran has too many equities in this part of the world, has been investing in this part of the world since for a long, long time, at least since the Iran Revolution, and has had a strategy and has been about implementing it since then. And so it's not going to give it up. I think limiting Iranian influence, I think it has a better shot in Iraq than it is in Syria. We have better intelligence, we have more assets, we have more leverage, we have more entry points. And as I said, compared to Syria today, we have more influence on the ground, for example, than before 2014, and Iran has a little bit less influence on the ground than before 2014. And again, this is a very short window where a smart strategy of U.S. engagement on a number of levels, helping Iraqis deal with the challenges of be it the KRG-Baghdad relationship. We are the only country that can be a mediator in that relationship, and there is a need for a trilateral dialogue to mediate it by, of course, the U.S. mediating the KRG, a dialogue between the KRG and Baghdad on the future, independence. If it is an independence, the terms of that independence need to be worked out and need to be. There is an assistance that definitely the United States can provide to Iraqi security forces that have proven their willingness, their ability to fight ISIS and to defend their cities. And that assistance need to continue, in terms of advice, train, and equip. There is humongous economic challenges facing Iraq, and that's where United States bilaterally or through multilateral organization can help Iraqi government make the tough decision that they need to make in terms of economic reforms, in terms of dealing with subsidies. You have 1 out of 5 Iraqis today is live below the poverty line. You have 9 million Iraqis that live directly or indirectly that are on the government payroll. You have 90% of the revenues of Iraq come from the oil sector. Even if the oil prices were to shoot up, there is not enough money that can come to Iraq from its oil resources to be able to meet the challenges. People need jobs. That requires hard structural reforms that people like Abadi have shown the willingness and the team around him to embark on, but they need some support, from the international community, from the United States, from the Arab countries. And then more importantly, the challenge of stabilizing the territories liberated from ISIS. And that should that responsibility should be taken up mostly by Arab countries, and the America and the United States government can help push, especially Gulf economic powerhouses to help with that financially, but also to help with that politically.
Mm. Mohammed, I'd be interested to ask you how some of the proxy conflicts you see taking place in the region, again, perhaps outside of Iraq and Syria, to what extent the outcome of those you think is going to define the future of Iranian influence in the region, looking at, like, Yemen, for example. How is the outcome of that going to affect the role that Iran thinks that it can play?
Sure. I mean, I think it's important to consider that Iran's regional proxy network is interconnected and operates to a great extent as one organism. A good example of this is about a year ago, North Korean missiles were discovered in Yemen. So these North Korean missiles were only given to North Korea by Russia. they were sold to the North Koreans. The North Koreans sold these missiles to the Assad regime. The Iranians were essentially rerouting resources from Syria to Yemen. Take, for example, all the propaganda that the Houthis use. Their strategy and their propaganda is all done in Dahiya and in Lebanon. So the entire network is interconnected. They reroute resources as they see fit. And this poses a direct threat to Saudi Arabia. If you were to talk to a Saudi a military official, what they will see is Iran at their border in both Yemen and in Iraq. There's a direct corridor through Iraq where they can deploy forces, both Iranian and Iraqi forces, and pose a threat to a border that's around 800 kilometers. So there's a real wariness of this threat, and countering it, I think, is at the top of the agenda.
Matt, my last question to you, and then I'd like to open it up to questions from the audience. What role do you think that the U.S. military has to play in containing Iran? When you look at the way that the U.S. has employed its military or not employed its military, you can see some indications that in terms of not providing airstrikes for the PMF, for example, or choosing to attack Iranian-backed militias in Syria that are coming too close to U.S. special forces. What role does the military play in terms of how the U.S. can shape Iran's role?
Well, I think, especially going back to Rhonda's last comment about the need for strategy, and I think this is one of the things that the current administration is taking a very hard look at about how should Iranian rollback, if you want to call it, or pushback, how that works, and then the role of the military and certainly special forces and other elements, clandestine elements, may need to play in that. One of the things I try to point out too is that you're going to have to carve up. You can have a kind of a grand strategy, but you're going to have to kind of carve up the theaters a little bit more locally. And recognize trying to push back, Iranian destabilizing activity and influence. In the areas that are existential to Iran's strategic interests, it's going to be very challenging for us to be able to do that, especially through the military, because these are things that are very entrenched, and particularly what I'm talking about is, Lebanon, particularly southern Lebanon, and the areas under Lebanese Hezbollah control, Damascus and the main corridor that Assad is keeping and in western Syria that I think Iran is going to want to preserve as much as possible. And then, of course, Baghdad and southern Iraq and anything along Iran's western border. These are geographically, as well as politically and security-wise, very much dominated, Iran is a predominant influence. And I think we have to look at those areas as mitigating and disrupting. And I think the military can play a role, particularly when it comes to preventing these areas from becoming worse. You can roll in the Yemen situation into this as well, as because as we've seen the acceleration of some of these advanced weapons getting to Iran's proxy groups that are potentially changing the calculus. Especially if you start looking at certain elements of the Houthis getting, versions of land attack cruise missiles and other, shorter range rockets that can reach Riyadh, that's a huge game changer for us. The same thing with what's maybe going into Lebanon right now, is something that the Israelis, as are watching very closely. And I fear, frankly, on the side, the Iranians and Lebanese Hezbollah and most Lebanese politicians are not quite getting an understanding of the Israeli red lines that are being laid out in the last year about LH's activities. But those areas, those are going to be tough for us to be pushed back, and especially from a military standpoint, aside from interdictions of weapons. The areas that are what I consider Iran's opportunistic growth areas in the last couple of years, which are particularly the Sunni areas of Iraq and Syria. We've talked a lot about the land bridge that may be emerging. These are areas that I think the U.S. is going to have higher rates of return on investment for pushing back because these are not, one, existential to Iran. So Iran is going to be more sensitive to U.S. coercive pressure or disruptive activity. And so I think these are areas that we can, that the military can play a key role in. The other thing is, you know, and I agree with Rhonda wholeheartedly on this, you know, Iraq, in the bigger scheme of things, Iraq is the main fulcrum point for us to be able to shape the dynamic with Iran regionally. And that is an area that, you know, the more we're willing to invest diplomatically as well as ensuring that we do have some, you know, military investment that allows some reassurance that there is going to be fallback for counterterrorism capacity, that we're not going to basically leave Iraq like we did last time, and it, because inevitably there's going to be ISIS, as we've heard, you know, 3.0 emerging, 2.0. And I fear our current strategy, even as we celebrate some of the victories in Mosul and elsewhere recently, you know, we are setting our, you know, ourselves up to having to repeat this later if we're not very careful. And I think we need to look at the role the U.S. military plays in shaping and influencing the Iraqi army, and even to some degree the PMF, as you mentioned, you know, we can, the Iranians, one of the reasons that's driving the Iranians to change their military structure and posture to the degree that they are, is because they recognize they were dependent in Syria on Russian close air support. And in Iraq, they were depending on American close air support. And these things, as I mentioned from time to time, are frankly probably humiliations for Tehran. Mm-hmm. The fact that their inability to ensure vital national security interests without depending on, you know, the U.S. and Russia to save them is something that is, I think, had a profound effect on the psyche of the Iranian leadership and is driving a lot of the changes that you've been seeing, particularly in the last year, at leadership levels, discussions about changing, you know, military doctrines to be more power projective, more offensive, because Iran has huge gaps in its ability to project power over land and air, let alone naval is a different issue. And I think these are all things that the U.S. presence helps mitigate and can shape, but at the same time we have to recognize that as we push back, we have to understand the things that are really vital for Iran. Iran is going to push back against us. But I do think as long as we understand, if we have escalation dominance and we can communicate that, you know, the Iranians have Dershan and Tony Korsman talked about this as well as Admiral Wildenfeld earlier today, that as long as they understand that escalation dominance, the Iranians do not want to engage in a conventional war with the United States. And they sense that the U.S. military is there and retains its escalation dominance capacity, you know, the Iranians are only going to push so far if they understand U.S. intent, and that U.S. intent is very clear.
So I believe that we have some microphones going around. If you have a question, please raise your hand. I'll call on you. Please identify yourself, and also if you have a question to a particular person. Sir, would you care to start?
Peter Humphrey, analyst and a former diplomat. There are two questions that we all need to see an answer to by the end of this year, I think. One is, YPG is not an occupation force. Hell of a fighting force, but not an occupation force. So they're not gonna run Raqqa, and we sure as hell ain't gonna hand it back to Bashar al-Assad. So give me plan C. Do we Berlin airlift the Free Syrian Army into Raqqa? I mean, that could work. And the second thing we need to see, oh my god, what are we talking about? Thousands of potential ISIS-Daesh fighters who are going to be rolled up here probably by the end of the year as they flee Raqqa to Deir ez-Zor, which is probably going to be the last stand of Daesh. Where are those guys going? Are we going to fly 2,000 Daesh fighters to Guantanamo, or does YPG get to do street justice on them? Just nobody has talked about that. So your thoughts.
Yeah, so what force is going to go into Raqqa, and what do we do with all of these? The military's options are die or surrender. Is that a good plan?
The issue, you know, particularly when it comes to our, what I call the partner challenge that we have, and if you listen to any of the leadership from General Townsend there, or General Votel, or General Dunford, or Secretary Mattis, they will always, they recognize the problem with using the YPG, for example, and they recognize the problems of the Syrian Defense Forces, the SDF forces, and the challenge there. The issue is, they'll come back with, what else have we got to work with? What is the other option? And I think, some would argue that you're not going to have that type of occupying force you're describing or sustaining force without building up the local capability there. And this, again, goes back to the larger problem that Iran, helps. This reason why it's so concerning if the Shia militia groups start, managing the Syrian-Iraqi border and have a more dominant security influences in traditional Sunni areas, that creates so much insecurity and resentment that, ISIS dash Al-Qaeda, we keep forgetting that Al-Qaeda is probably the other really long-term problem here, can exploit and use in the future. But the challenge for us is, how do you work with those forces after what they, especially on the Iraqi side of the equation? The Syrian side, we have a other kind of difficult history there. But on the Iraqi side, we had the Sakhwa, we had the Sons of Iraq, we had, the uprising that we were able to work with in 2006 and 2007 and 2008. But there's a sense after kind of what we did in 2011 and beyond, that lack of confidence in the U.S. Among Sunni communities to stick with them. And I think this is going to be a huge challenge for us trying to figure out what to do after Raqqa, after potentially Deir ez-Zor, even after Mosul, Tal Afar, all these areas that we're working on to clear out Daesh. Again, that's reason, and as you mentioned, where Daesh is going, I mean, this is why I worry we're going to have to keep refighting this if we don't think through how to, create a more stable situation that everyone feels like they have a security stake in locally. And I think this is going to be a big problem.
Ron? Well, I mean, in terms of former Daesh fighters, I think there are now officials, Iraqi officials, who believe that many of them now are starting to melt away in the Jazeera desert of northwest Iraq from where they started. And that's where they're going to, try to reemerge, and conduct an insurgency campaign. The problem is not about Raqqa. I mean, the problem definitely is the problem of Raqqa. But here we have Mosul that has been pretty much liberated from ISIS. And we still have, the Iraqi government and the international community does not have a plan for economic reconstruction of Mosul and of the Nineveh province. I mean, so Raqqa might take 7-8 months from now. We have now an immediate problem, and neither Baghdad nor the KRG nor the international community has a plan of how we're going to reintegrate these Sunni communities, how we're going to help with the reconstruction. It's Mosul, it's Nineveh, but also the record so far of reconstruction post-liberation in Ramadi, Fallujah is really not good. And so Iraq might have a year to 2 years, as a grace period, because people are willing to give the Iraqi government that much time to be able to get its act together. But if the Iraqi government does not get its act together within the next 1 to 2 years on the reconstruction front, on the security front, local security, on the economic front, I'm afraid that definitely we're going to see a reemergence and resurgence of whatever, ISIS.3, ISIS 3.0, 4.0.
I've heard military assessments that they're planning to use the model that they've built in liberating the major cities in Iraq as one that they could apply later to Syria. Does that make sense?
I think Mosul, as we've seen, has been far more of a destructive campaign than we even anticipated originally. But I think using, we have in Iraq, it's a different situation because we obviously have very close, or at least long-standing relationship with the Iraqi army, with some of their special units and counterterrorism units, and for better or for worse, we have worked with or allowed the PMF to kind of be part of this campaign. In Syria is a totally different situation because we don't have a kind of an institution like the Iraqi army that we can reinforce through the campaign, and put up as a a way forward to provide long-term security for the state. I mean, I don't think the forces we're working with right now really represent that. And so we may, from a tactical and operational standpoint, we may be taking some of these cues from Mosul and elsewhere as we move throughout eastern Syria. But I think it's, you know, for us, we have a smaller footprint there, and we have our partner, you know, our partner forces are not, or even sometimes even more problematic from a political standpoint, even though they have some impressive warfighting capabilities.
More questions? Please. Would you wait for the microphone, please?
Yeah.
Right behind.
Lori Milroy, Kurdistan 24. I have a question primarily for Rhonda, but for anyone else who would like to comment. And I really enjoyed your most informative presentation. I wondered, in respect of what Senator Kuhn said before this panel, and that Kurdistan should remain part of Iraq in order to contain Iran, whether that's a reasonable, you know, reasonable way of looking at things. And then you talked about the lack of U.S. planning for Mosul. I wonder, it seems to me that U.S. officials are not looking at a situation in which there is likely to be on September 25 an overwhelming majority for independence in the Kurdistan region. And in the disputed territories where this referendum will be held too, there may be votes for independence that suggest the disputed territories would rather be, some of them at least, part of the Kurdistan region than part of Iraq. So my question is, do you think that the explanation offered by Senator Kuhn's, you know, keep Kurdistan part of Iraq in order to contain Iran makes a lot of sense, or is it a recipe for further problems?
Somebody who has traveled to, you know, Kurdish areas have been talking to Kurdish officials, but also to average, you know, citizens of the KRG region. I think the Kurds have checked out psychologically out of Iraq. And I think that train has left the station. And so I understand Senator Kuhn's and the United States government position, because definitely a strong unitary Iraq is in a better position to stand up to Iran than a divided Iraq, that's for sure. But at the same time, there are certain dynamics on the ground which are going to be hard to reverse. And I think also, on the other hand, we need not look at the September 25 referendum as synonymous with the Declaration of Independence. I think the September 25 referendum is a point to start negotiations between Iraq, between Baghdad and the KRG on the future of their relationship. And these negotiations could go into a number of scenarios depending on how they evolve. Look, there is, it's going to be a hard road for the KRG to, even if they get a majority in the referendum, to go move forward right now with independence, primarily not only because of economic difficulties, of the economic situation, but also because of the geopolitical consideration. And we have already heard Iran saying, you know, an independent KRG is going to be a red line for them almost. And that's part of their understanding and their fear of how a disintegrated Iraq can provide opportunities for collusion between these independent entities like the KRG with regional countries as well as with outside parties, specifically Israel. I mean, when you talk with Iranian officials, they always talk about an independent Kurdistan within the construct of Ben-Gurion periphery theory, and that this is it's going to be an Israeli and American satellite on their border. And so they're going to try, using as many levers as they have, including leverage they have inside the Kurdistan relationship with certain Kurdish parties, especially the PUK, for example, they're going to try to make, you know, this kind of scenario very difficult and unachievable, or at least extremely costly to achieve. Turkey has also come out against this scenario, and these are the two regions that matter really in this situation here. But I think Turkey can be, you know, convinced eventually to support an independent KRG pending certain agreement on the foreign policy of the KRG, the relationship that the KRG will have with Turkey, the relationship that KRG will have with Baghdad and with other entities, especially Sunni, and the disputed territories, because that has to be solved as far as Turkey is concerned. So ideally, yes, a strong unitary Iraq is definitely a better, formula to limit Iranian influence in Iraq. But realistically, I think we can, keep saying repeating this platitude of a unitary Syria, of unitary Iraq. But I think the dynamics on the ground, the psychology of the people on the ground, especially in the KRG, seems to indicate that it's time to part ways. But it has to be done under certain negotiated terms, and that's where the United States can play a role of mediating that dialogue between them.
I know Matt's going to have to duck out in a few minutes for another appointment, so if anybody has a last question for him before he leaves, yep. Do you have time for it, please? Gentlemen in the
question.
Seat. You, sir.
So the question that I have, we're, I think, a little bit too much in the weeds. If we pull back and look at the overall situation, so what is the interest of Iran with respect to Iraq specifically? It seems to me, based on past experience, and we have a million dead soldiers on the ground, Saddam Hussein with the support of the Saudi and UAE and all of that stuff. So the interest of Iran is to have a friendly government.
Yes.
And an Iraq that is whole, not parts, pieces, and all of that. So that, to me, is a logical deduction that we can have from what Iran wants. Okay. What is it that the U.S. wants other than cozying up to Saudi Arabia, playing sword dance, and all of that stuff? What is our interest in this whole situation? And once we define that, then how do we go about it? We're always in the, they came here, they came there, they did this, they did that. But what is the big picture in all of this?
Broad question. Does somebody want to? Can you stab it then?
Go ahead.
The issue for Iran and Iraq, vice how it plays its game and its strategy in the Levant and down in Yemen, Bahrain, elsewhere. For Iraq, it is an existential issue for the Iranians. Obviously because of the border and their long term interest in is if they want to have that dominant leadership role, not only in a classic geopolitical sense in the region, but within the Islamic world and within the Shia community, that Iraq, as Rhonda had mentioned before, Iraq represents the key kind of counterpoint to Iran in its efforts to do so. And so I think that what you look at what Iran's strategy there in Iraq, it's a combination of the need to, that almost ideological competition that the Saudis are engaged in as well, and frankly ISIS and Al Qaeda, everyone's engaged in this. Who's going to lead the Middle? Who's going to lead the Islamic world within the Islamic community? They all have different versions of this, and I think that the Iranians have a certain political and ideological interest in this contest in Iraq, but you obviously have clear geopolitical reasons for their own preservation, especially after the recent attack by ISIS in Tehran. They know that that's going to be the main vector through which they're going to have increasing terrorism problems. And so I think that for the Iranians, it's a combination of both, whereas in the Levant, it's a little bit more, I think it's a little bit more ideological because of the contest against Israel. And I think, but as you seen them switch and move forces back and forth, depending on which one's a more dire situation, Iraq will get most of the effort. Sometimes it switches back to Syria by Iran, but ultimately I think Iraq will matter more than even Syria.
Mohammed, let me put a bit of a spin on that question. What do you think are specific outcomes that the U.S. or the Iraqi central government might be looking for that would signal that they're having success insofar as they wish to contain Iran?
Well, I think one of the biggest mistakes that the Gulf states made, especially Saudi Arabia, is that there was no engagement with Iraq after 2003.
Exactly.
You know, the mentality when you look at, when you talk to officials in Saudi Arabia is, you know, we told the U.S. five times this is a bad idea. You shouldn't be going into Iraq. It's their mess. They deal with it. The U.S. administration asked the Saudis to come and join the United States in looking after its interests. They could have went in, engaged with Arab Shias, engaged with Ashar more. Now, there was engagement, but it wasn't enough. Today, what's happening is that they're trying to play catch-up. Whether that works or it doesn't remains to be seen. But just to touch on Iranian policy in the region, the tactics are important. We do have to talk about Iran did this there and did that there. If you look at the Hashd al-Sha'bi, there are elements of the Hashd al-Sha'bi that are not equally as barbaric as ISIS is. You know, there's no difference between putting somebody in a cage and burning them alive, like ISIS did with Mu'adh al-Qasasbe, and Abu Israel, a Hashd figure, cutting somebody up like a kebab on top of a bonfire. I'm sorry for putting this image in your head, but this is one and the same. ISIS conducts attacks on Western capitals. We see them in Europe. We see them elsewhere. But if you look at people in the region, they view Iranian IRGC-backed militias as equally barbaric, equally problematic as ISIS is. And they're symbiotic. The only reason ISIS enjoys tolerance by the people in the areas that it controls is because they fear these Iran-backed terrorists are worse when it comes to Sunnis than ISIS is. So they benefit from each other, the Hashd al-Sha'bi, these elements of the Hashd al-Sha'bi and ISIS, and this is the problem.
Rana?
Yeah, back to your question. I think it's also important to look at how Iran look at the threats now that emanate from Iraq. Because the principal objective of Iran has been for Iraq not to be a base to attack Iran from, be it by American forces in 2003 and during the American occupation of Iraq, or be it by regional powers using Iraq to attack Iran. I think today Iran is no longer threatened by a traditional military threat from Iraq, you know, especially with the Iraqi armed forces, the way they are structured. This is not the source of threat for Iran from Iraq. I think the source of threat for Iran from Iraq today is instability, is civil war, like was the case in 2005-2006, is Sunni extremism, is disintegration of Iraq leading to the establishment, as I said earlier, of satellites on its border that are pro-US, pro-Israel. It's the Sunni community of Iraq. Although Iran has cultivated relations with some moderate, you know, Sunni groups, but Iran looks at the Arab Sunni of Iraq as being the vector or as being the carrier or the implementer of an anti-Iran, anti-Shia regional agenda, or at least of having the potential to play that role. And so hence Iran's attempt to infiltrate itself in the security structure through proxies that it can control, it can trust. It's not necessary. I don't think Iran wants only a friendly government in Baghdad. I think Iran, given these source of threats, needs a subservient government in Iran, in Iraq. And that's the struggle that Iraqis, especially within the Shia, among Shia political elites, are fighting over right now, is what kind of relationship we should have with Iran, and how much of a role can we play in limiting that kind of Iranian influence Iran. And that's why I think going forward, we are not going to see disbanding of part of the PMF that have allegiance to Iran. This is their primary guarantee that Iran will never in the future be that kind of source of threats that I talked about. I mean, and it's going to be not all the PMF. Remember, the kind of groups that Iran works with are groups that, and that distinguishes them from the other parts of the PMF, are groups that have that have given allegiance to Wilayat Faqih. And this is few of the militias that are now part of the PMF. Not all of them. Definitely it's not Muqtada Sadr's militia. Definitely it's not Sistani's PMF. And it's definitely not all of the pro-Iran militias, you know, a good part of them. So these are the PMF that Iran is going to fight tooth and nail to make sure that they are not disbanded and that they are not only not disbanded, but they are very well integrated in Iraqi security structure.
We have less than 10 minutes left, so why don't we bundle together a couple questions and then we can go at it together. Sir, one, sir, two, and three, right here.
Yeah, I feel like we do not, I suggest that we take a more regional approach to the analysis. I've seen a lot of talk about Iran. I do not like the regime, and I think that Iran is a hegemonic system. But what about Saudi Arabia and the approach it's taking toward Qatar and toward Yemen, a very devastating war? And so there's when we talk about Tehran, we are very assertive, whereas when we talk about Riyadh, we are very polite. I think only Professor Kotman gave a subtle reference to the emirs who are adult men who are mature but not sober. And then there is the role of Israel in and Palestine, an unresolved question, which is also the dynamics of Iranian presence in the region, which is not helping. So, and then there is the policy of Washington in dealing with siding with one side and against another. And how, why is Iran now the big elephant and the others are really okay? So I
fair.
Would
yeah.
just
sorry,
it's a
great.
Question
so,
of to be more regional in both analysis and conflict resolution.
Very good. Thank you, sir. Sir in the pink shirt. Salmon colored shirt.
I honestly don't know what the color is myself, but my question would be, during the Iraq War, Sadr was both very opposed to the United States, and even though he wasn't personally a big fan of Iran, accepted Iranian support, whereas recently when I went to Iraq, now that the U.S. has withdrawn, Sadr and the peace companies very much stressed that, unlike the other groups, they did not get weapons from Iran and were not particularly eager to work with them. And I think they even had a minor conflict with the Badr organization. So does the U.S. now have an opportunity to work with not only Sistani, but also Sadr and his followers in a way that it didn't during the Iraq War?
So we'll limit it to those questions since we are short on time. But do you want to take that second one
quickly,
first and then?
Quickly. I think it's going to be hard, partly because Sadr's nationalist streak, I think it's going to be hard for him, given his brand, to work with the Americans. And in fact, you raise a very good question. Is once Iraq declares that all of Iraq has been liberated from ISIS, because now we have a number of battles still that are important, and the most important one, in my opinion, and the most difficult one that is coming up is Hawija, which is a very, very tricky city to work on, and where Daesh has had a lot of support from the local community. So once that happens, what's going to be the position of groups like Sadr? What's going to be the position of pro-Iranian militias? What's going to be the position of Sistani, you know, on the American presence? Are we going to see a repeat of 2011 when basically Maliki, pressured by the Iranians, made it almost impossible for the Americans to stay there? Although I have to say that at the time the Obama administration was just wanting to get out and needed an excuse to get out, but then Maliki and the Iranian provided it. And because, again, another objective of the Iranians right now, you know, they need the American air support to help the Iraqi security forces defeat ISIS or liberate these towns from ISIS. Once that support is no longer needed, I mean, an Iranian objective, long-standing objective, is to deny I mean, or is to evict or to force Americans out of the region, out especially out of Iraq. And so what's going to be then the strategy next? And that's going to be interesting to watch. And that will be in the thick, and this debate will start at right as the preparation are happening for the parliamentary and provincial elections in Iraq, which is now slated for the spring of 2018. So if the battle against ISIS is going to last that long, as many people are expecting, then this will be the time when then you are going to have all these political, you know, Iraqi political figures trying to outdo each other about who's going to be anti-American more than the others.
So, Mohammed, you have the last word in perhaps a few seconds. Could the U.S. afford to be more critical of its allies, at least rhetorically, when it talks about Iran?
I'll get to that, but just answer the other question that was asked first a little bit. You know, it's my understanding that Sistani, Muqtada al-Sadr, and other Shia leaders, first of all, engagement with them could go could be through Arab actors engaging with Arab Shias. Direct engagement with the United States, I think, as Randa mentioned, isn't very doable. But also one must consider that Iran is exercising unprecedented power in Iraq. So even if Sistani wanted to come out and say that he's against certain elements of the Hashd al-Shaabi, Shias will still join these groups, and he will just diminish his own position. And the same with Muqtada al-Sadr. It's very clear that Iran is already exercising power on the ground that diminishes the power of these actors to make meaningful decisions on these topics. In terms of the point about Saudi Arabia, I mean, Saudi Arabia is criticized a lot. But there is no comparison between what Saudi Arabia does in the region and what Iran does. I think this is the biggest problem in, when analyzing this issue. People think that there's false balance and there's asymmetry in the way we look at these countries. If Iran has 47 militias in Iraq, if it carries out bombings, if it does this and that, then Saudi Arabia must be doing the same. They must be funding ISIS. They must be funding Al-Qaeda. And this is plaguing analysis on the region. It's very problematic. In Yemen, for example, Saudi Arabia waited from September to March, September 2014 to March 2015 in order to intervene. They view it as their backyard. It was a major security threat. They intervened after a UN resolution. Comparing that to a country that has militias that are from right next to its borders in Iraq until Lebanon and then in Yemen, a country that's sending arms shipments to Bahrain that end up in Saudi Arabia through the causeway, that have cells in Kuwait, that have cells in the United Arab Emirates. There's just no comparison. It is a false balance, and it's a false comparison. That's going to lead us nowhere, I think.
Well, with that, please join me in thanking our panelists for their time today.